She goes, Mom, you're not going to believe this. I'm not having those issues anymore. And I'm not to feel hungry,
definitely.
Not having that urge to eat.
Yeah.
It's a dream come true. But the reality is, and I'm seeing the same mistake in a lot of the women that I work with GLP-1, is they're not eating enough.
Well, welcome back to the relaunch of the third season of the Another Angle podcast. I'm here today with one of our guests from the first half of this year, Van Patel, the dietologist. We're going to be chatting about bariatric surgery and busting a whole bunch of weight loss myths and getting some of her hot takes. Amazing. Well, thank you very much for coming on for a second time around now. It's been how many months now? It's only been a few.
I think it's been about 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, it's nothing bad though.
Obviously. Thanks for inviting me back.
Yeah, no, it's all right. Absolutely.
I must have done all right last time.
I was going to say, I'd star guest last time, so it makes complete sense you're back. Obviously, very active in the dieting space, especially within weight loss. If you wanted to maybe give yourself a little bit of an introduction for the people back at home that might not have seen the first session, then we can kind of get stuck into it.
Yeah, so my name's Van, I'm the dietologist. Yep. I'm a GLP-1 and weight loss surgery dietitian.
Cool.
And I've been running this gig for about almost 35 years. And I've seen every mistake every woman can make.
Yep.
When it comes to weight loss, including myself. And we
Absolutely.
Spoke about both our stories.
Yeah.
When it came to weight loss and yep. habits last time. So, and I think it's really important to understand women and men with their stories, because it's that awareness of why do I do these things, why do I overeat, why can't I lose the weight. It's the why is the most important thing. So I think I'm almost more interested in the why rather than the what are they doing right now. That why drives what they're doing right now.
Absolutely. I understand, obviously, last time we spoke pretty heavily on the emotional eating side of weight loss, you know, the state of obesity throughout the entirety of the UK, both between adults and, you know, childhood, and getting that kind of information out there. I think more so wanting to touch on your relationship with people going through, I guess, the surgery side of things. So they are obviously far higher up on the BMI scale. I think the emotional roller coaster that comes with actually mentally prepping and going, I need to have this procedure done. I guess how would you best help people through that time when it is, you know, obvious that they need to go out of their way, have that medical intervention, and then how can they adjust their lifestyle afterwards?
So most of the people that probably have surgery, well, especially before the GLP-1s came on the scene, would probably go through a vicious cycle of dieting and regaining, the yo-yo cycle. And they've got to a point where their eating is out of control, their lifestyle, their habits, and internally they've developed inflammation, insulin resistance, and it's pretty much they've lost a lot of muscle as well because they've been on these low-calorie diets. And what happens is their metabolism cannot cope.
Right.
So they can go through every diet and lose weight very quickly initially, and then they'll get stuck, and that is it. They have to pretty much starve themselves to lose weight, which then for them reaffirms, oh, the low-calorie diet is the best way to lose weight. But each time they're doing that, they're losing more muscle, losing
just
their...
getting worse and worse.
Yeah, metabolic health. So then the next thing that most patients will go through, if it's not via the NHS, via myself or private healthcare, is some form of weight management. And that will generally happen in the NHS more than the private sector. So they have to, it was an area that I really disliked actually in the NHS weight management tier system. And the reason being is I think every person that goes through that tier two weight management and tier two, they feel like they're being judged. It's a test. And really it is in a sense, because we want to see, can they change their habits? Can they change their lifestyle? Can they change the way that they eat so that they can prepare for surgery? And on one hand, it's really good to have that year of doing that and to lose the weight.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, for the patient, it's very traumatic.
I was going to say, it sounds like it's not much of a support system. It's more or less just like this rigorous...
Well, if
you think examination
about, yeah,
of the
they'll
behavior.
Probably get maybe 2 or 3 consults throughout that year, because the NHS cannot cope. It generally cannot cope. So I think patients will feel very alone, just to get on with things. But where I worked previously, there was a great support system because there were groups and so forth, and they could all connect, and they go through a psychological process as well. So they're assessed, are they fit for surgery?
Yeah.
Are they mentally fit for surgery as well as physically fit for surgery? Mm. And then once they've achieved 10% weight loss, we would have an MDT meeting to say, is this patient able to cope with surgery? And hopefully, yes.
Yeah.
Then they would then have the surgery. But then again, they're on a waiting list again, and they're like, it's like forever. Whereas if you go privately, do you meet the criteria? Right, great, okay. There you go, we can book you in 10 days' time.
Brilliant.
So they would have a preoperative stage where they've got to be on a low-calorie diet, and it's to shrink the liver.
Mm.
And during that process, you can see all these dieting fads coming through. But generally, it's a high-protein, low-carb diet.
Okay.
To shrink the liver. They do that so they can prepare for surgery. And the reason for doing that liver shrinkage diet is because the liver sits in front of the stomach and the procedures are done laparoscopically.
Mm.
So by shrinking the stomach, it just gives the surgeon easier access to get into the to get to the stomach laparoscopically. And it makes it safer for the patient. People that stick to the diet recover a lot better.
Mm.
But again, for that patient, it's another test.
Mm.
You know, and I see so in all these forums, oh gosh, you know, I'm on day three. I can't cope with this low calorie diet. All I want to do is eat a steak, or I just want a burger.
Yeah.
So it's so, you know, again, it's another, I think for these patients, everything feels like it's a test.
I was going to say, it just sounds like it's quite drastic measures, especially when you're under that microscope, right? Like if you are going through those procedures and, you know, you've been being put through the NHS system, it sounds like they're very much on your case, making sure they're doing every single critical step completely correctly. Otherwise, you might feel in yourself that you're failing.
There's a punishment at the other end of the, you know, the outcome is, if you've been good, like, you know, the good person, the good diet, you're going to get the surgery, but if you haven't, you're not happy.
They just don't. So what happens to those people that, let's say they aren't good, and say, even if they're like 70% of the way there, but they've just decided that, no, we're not going to be going through with this. What happens to
them? It all depends, because there's a bit of leeway.
Yeah.
You can get away with probably having a few more calories, and it's fine. As long as the liver's shrunk, you can have that procedure. But a surgeon will attempt to do the procedure, and if the liver is too large, they'll have to abandon and say, look, we can't perform it. It's not safe enough to do it. But the surgeon will, and a lot of skilled surgeons will be able to do it. And the fact is that a lot of patients that go abroad aren't even told to do a pre-op diet.
Bloody hell.
But then what happens is they have to pump more gas into the stomach cavity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the abdominal cavity.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a lot of gas pain after the surgery. So that's why the recovery is more painful and may take a lot longer.
Okay. So let's say in a typical patient that you see as well, what is that kind of recovery time frame that they can expect?
Generally about 2 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's actually
doesn't
a lot quicker
mean
than I thought.
They might not be able to drive, they may not feel their self, but generally within 2 weeks they can go back to like daily living. They may find that they can't lift heavy weights, doing the washing and laundry, but that's not a bad thing now, is it?
Yeah.
But they will generally in a couple of weeks they will feel pretty good, and that's because the procedure is laparoscopic, whereas many years ago, you'd have a full cut down the front, and that would take a lot longer to recover. But because it's laparoscopic, recovery is a lot quicker.
Okay. Is there any, just obviously you talk about the history of it, and obviously it was a far longer process for you to recover. Is there any developments in the future that you're seeing on the horizon that can make these procedures even more safe, or, you know, if it's potentially viable for people on a slightly lower BMI?
There's more robotic surgery.
Okay.
Yeah, so I can see that probably helping.
Yeah.
Making procedure times probably shorter.
Okay.
But like a gastric sleeve, a skilled surgeon can do it within 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah. Do you think it will always hold at that kind of BMI threshold? It's like, I know it's around 55, right?
Well, that's the extreme, but you can have bariatric surgery from BMI 30-35.
Really? Yeah. I not know that. Yeah. That low?
Yeah. Well, but the thing is, we think it's low because we work in this industry of weight loss. Whereas if you think a good BMI is between 20 and 24.9.
Actually, that's true as well.
Yeah, so it's about 10 units, 5 to 10 units above.
Interesting. But I mean, I think my point is that it's just interesting that the entry point for like GLP-1 medications and bariatric surgery are technically at the same
very similar because level. You can have GLP-1s from 27, you can't have bariatric surgery.
That's true. But I mean, it's a difference of 3, right? Like, it's not exactly a significant...
But the thing, the BMI 30 is more for, like, they used to do gastric bands at BMI 30.
Yeah.
There's a procedure called an ESG where it's more of an endoscopic procedure where the stomach is literally stitched together.
Right.
And now, for some... And it depends on the patient, but generally 35 is the starting point. So yeah, so it's a lot lower than you think.
But yeah, that is.
We think it's low because we work in this industry of weight loss, but generally it's still a very high.
That's true, actually. I feel, yeah, there's definitely a bias coming in from the fact that we're just seeing it like day to day.
Yeah.
You know, I completely understand.
And also
that.
When we see patients, like, it's like body image distortion because what we see as normal may not be somebody else's normal because we're dealing with larger patients. Probably there's a post-op diet that they need to follow that can be quite restrictive as well.
Is there?
After they've had the procedure, yeah.
Okay, so what does that entail?
So the post-op diet is all about the stomach healing.
Yeah.
But again, it's going to feel like another test for the patient.
Yeah, yeah.
So for the first couple of weeks, they're on liquids only, so they'll be on protein shakes, water, maybe soup with no bits in. Then they're weaned onto a puree diet for a week, then a soft diet, then before they get to solids.
Right.
So there's this progression, but during that progression, they've got to use it as a bit of a training ground because how you eat after you have the surgery is very different to how these patients may have eaten before. So, for example, they've got to really take small bites, they've got to chew their food well, they can't eat and drink together.
Mm.
They've got to make sure that they're engaging in hunger and fullness now, just like GLP-1s, bariatric surgery affects the gut hormones, so they don't generally feel hungry. So for anybody that wants to lose weight, that's just a blessing, isn't it? Not to feel hungry,
definitely.
Not having that urge to eat.
Yeah.
It's a dream come true. But the reality is, and I'm seeing the same mistake in a lot of the women that I work with GLP-1, is they're not eating enough.
No, not at all. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's obviously the nutrient side of things as well.
Yeah.
I know that we covered that pretty heavily last time, but it's such an obvious thing that I think people just overlook, especially when they are, you know, jumping on that weight management plan. They've just decided
Absolutely. So there's the diets are very similar.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to fuel your body, you've got to nourish your body.
Yeah.
And again, with the GLP-1s, I feel I'm seeing so many similarities
that
these eating techniques that, you know, slowing down, avoiding eating and drinking together are really important with GLP-1s too.
Definitely.
Yeah, because I'm finding that when women are eating and drinking together, which is what we don't recommend that you do when you have bariatric surgery, it makes you feel really nauseous.
Yeah, I have heard that quite a few times as well.
Yeah, so when they're eating fatty food and sweet food, they're having problems with their bowels, and it's the same. Literally, I really do feel GLP-1s is like a medical bariatric surgery.
I was just about to say, like, is it what's the actual like medical implication from the GLP-1s that causes that though? Is it like, is it just literally limiting like nutrient quality that you just have to be eating very well in order for you to feel fine? Like, you talk about fatty foods and like sweet foods and drinking alcohol.
It
obviously
says, if you think about GLP-1s and bariatric surgery,
yeah,
they affect the gut hormones in a very similar way.
Okay.
And so food sits in your stomach for a lot longer.
Right.
But if you're eating and drinking, if you think about when you drink, you're starting to flush the food out of your stomach.
Gotcha.
So it gets into the bowel, the small bowel and the rest of the bowel a lot quicker than it needs to.
Yeah.
And that has a bit of a reaction. And that's why a lot of people may suffer with constipation, the sulfur burps and so forth, because the food is, the gut is just generally slowing down. And it's doing that, and by slowing down, the food sits in your stomach longer, you feel fuller for longer.
Okay, that's very good to know.
And even when you eat and drink together, again, that can have the physical impact of possible diarrhea as well.
Yeah.
Which is what the symptoms would be when you're eating something very sweet or very fatty. We call it dumping syndrome, but I think there's a GLP-1 dumping syndrome as well.
Right, so your body's just flushing it all out, basically.
Yeah,
Interesting. Okay, so we've talked quite heavily on, I guess, the nutrition side of things. I think, especially, let's say, post-op as well, you know, obviously you're talking about those very constricting diets and everything, but I think we wanted to just chat on, I guess, having a really solid support system, like in and around you as well. Like, obviously, friends and family, you need people that are able to kind of advocate for what you're doing, you know, kind of pushing you along in the right direction. And I think that, and also just the changes in self-image. I know a lot of people, especially when they do lose drastic amounts of weight in a very short period of time, body dysmorphia is obviously a massive implication of that. So I think if you can just touch on those two areas and how what you've seen in your own patients.
So if we think about the first part of that question, the people that you surround yourself, well, we're all a product of the people that we surround ourselves with.
That's true.
So something that I'm seeing that's so common among in the bariatric community and in the GLP-1 community is the fact that all of a sudden you've just made an investment to change your health, for whether it's because you want to look and feel better, whether it's for health reasons, whatever it is, and you're losing weight. And then all of a sudden, obviously, people around you notice that you're losing weight. The thing is, you might have kept the GLP-1 secret, which I think a lot of people do. But what I'm finding is that actually on social media, people keep it a secret, and then they're on social media and sharing their stories.
Very vocal, very vocal.
But you're changing, but your circumstances and the people around you aren't changing.
Yeah.
So we eat for so many different reasons. We eat to fuel our bodies because our energy is low. We eat because a parent or a friend is making food. We might not be hungry, but we eat it to respect the cook. We eat because there's free food at work, because we don't get very many rewards. Hopefully, Fair Hunter, enough. You get a lot of rewards at Right Angle. So when the donuts come on Friday, you don't feel you need to have all of them. So, you know, free food.
Yeah.
When food is free, all of a sudden, I want to eat it. You might not be hungry.
Yeah.
So if we're not changing who we're surrounding ourselves with, and especially if they're not supportive and they're, let's say you're making a real intention to be healthier, you want to be high protein, you're having your salads, you're being mindful of your carbs, and you know, you're really on this health kick, but then no one else around you isn't, and there you go, there's a bucket of KFC, or there's the pizza, or the takeaway.
Absolutely.
It's hard.
I completely understand that, like, preaching to the choir, to be fair. I mean, like, being a 25-year-old that's, like, relatively fresh to London, obviously there's just so many things going on, and like the amount of times that you just chat to your mates is like, oh, we'll go to the pub, have a few kind of thing, and then you have a few, and then you end up at McDonald's, and then it's just a whole rinse and repeat, and you've like reset your calorie track for that week kind of thing. I completely understand that. It's just like, it's the small bits that you just don't even think about. And I think the free side's a really funny angle to go along as well, because I find that I'm so much more aware of what I'm putting into my body if I'm going out of my way paying for it and cooking it myself. If I'm given free food, or if I, like, you know, go around to my girlfriend's house kind of thing and she's cooking, I'm just loving it. I'm just loving the fact that she's cooking. So I just don't even consider any of that. So, yeah.
Do you think that is?
I think it's probably just a bit of an enjoyment out of the novelty of just being cooked for. Like, it could just be like just a big old bowl of pasta and you're just not even thinking about it. Whereas back at home, if I was just cooking for myself, it'd be like mince, broccoli, rice, bit of seasoning kind of thing, call it a day. Like, much more lean and obviously like towards my goals. But I think there's also the fact that there's a bit of moderation in that as well. I think being able to let yourself go and go like, oh, hey, like, I can do this maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks kind of thing, and just not really think about it, you know.
I think that's a really good thing, because otherwise you're all or nothing, and I think we spoke about this last time, didn't we?
It's too constructive.
Whereas if you have this balance where it's like, I use this 80-20 rule all of the time, where 80% of the time I am consistent with my breakfast. I'm a two meal and two snack person. It works for me. It may not be the right thing for somebody else, but for me, that's how I operate, and it works for my body, it works for my health, it works with my training.
Yeah.
But if at the weekend, my eating is completely different, you know, we'll all have a takeaway.
Yeah.
You know, people call it a cheat meal or a cheat day, you know, but I'll be like, you know what, I really fancy some pizza, because all I've had is salad and chicken and a few potatoes, you know, most days. And I'm very much, I can go eat in the same meal, the same lunch, same breakfast, because I work in this industry of food and weight loss. just don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
I just want to keep it really simple.
Yeah.
So at the weekend, it's like, oh, my bride, I'll have some sushi. Let's have a pizza. I have to admit, I had some KFC because the kids want, you know, the influenced by the kids. And I was like, oh, I love a hot wing. But the last time I had KFC was probably about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
So it's all about moderation and balance. And that 80-20 rule is flexible eating.
Yeah.
And I live by it. It works for me.
Absolutely.
And it generally is something that I instill in the people that I work with as well.
Myself, if I was in that position and I had been eating quite poorly for years on end and then being forced into that, I can just see a moment where they would snap.
And I think that's where education comes in.
Yeah.
Explaining to them why you've got to follow this diet rather than this is what you've got to do, which is what I think a lot of practitioners do. You've got to follow this diet.
Definitely.
And the reason why many people don't do the things that they need to do is because they're not told why. So I'll always explain the reason why you've got to do this is because your stomach's healing.
Yeah.
And we want those wounds to heal.
Yeah.
So that your stomach heals so that it can take you through to the next month, you know, to so that you can tolerate the real food when you go back into it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, it's like, and I always say, it's like a child. When you have a child, initially they're on liquids because they're drinking milk.
Yeah.
You don't go into giving them a roast dinner straight away.
No.
They've got to learn how to eat, and it's the same for them. So I always say it's like pretty much like weaning a child. Obviously, you're not a child, you're an adult.
Readjusting.
Yeah, just your stomach needs to readjust. It can't cope with solid food at that stage. And so we wean you. We're building you back up to eating normal food again.
Okay.
And how normal food will look for you is it's going to look different for everybody. You know, what you're. But generally, again, very similar to GLP-1, it's a high protein diet, moderate carb, lots of fiber, because it keeps you feeling fuller for longer. But again, I'm adapting a lot of the information that we do with bariatrics with GLP-1s because I'm seeing all the similar side effects when they're not, like I said, the GLP-1 dumping, I'm going to call it.
Yeah.
We're getting a lot of that. So.
Okay, interesting. Mm. I mean, yeah, that's obviously all very solid information that I think people will really appreciate. We've got a bit of a segment that we're wanting to run with you. It's called Hot Takes and Cold Truths. So... we're just wanting to get some of your insights as well, and obviously, you know, tell people down the barrel what they probably might not want to hear. Do you think this is a hot take or a cold truth? Calories are all that matter for weight loss.
Oh, cold truth.
Cold truth. Can you elaborate?
You could have, let's say, in my toolkit, I say, you know, 1,500 calorie diet. Now you can adapt it. You can have slightly lower, you can have a lot more. But you've got to work that out with a calculator. Now, how the macro split of that is really matters to your weight loss results. So you could have 1,500 calories of sugar. Now, your body responding to sugar and the hormonal effect of it is probably going to lead to gaining fat because of the insulin hormone. Whereas if that's a 1,500 calorie diet that's balanced well with protein, fiber, some carbs, you're not going to get those insulin spikes. So that's why I really do feel that calories, they're important, but the macro split is more important.
Okay, so you would say that macros kind of reign supreme.
Macros with calories. So
you
can use a calculator.
Yep.
I encourage it in my toolkit as well, and with my patients, I'll work out a guide and I'll say, right, this is where your calories are. Now, to lose about a pound a week, we need to drop by about 500 calories. So they might be at, let's say, about 2,000 if they're fairly sedentary.
Yeah.
Let's drop it to 1,500. But how you know, how much protein is on your plate is going to make such a huge difference with not just how your hormones are going to react to that meal, but also your fullness, how you're going to feel energized and so forth. Whereas if you have 1,500 calories of sugar, you're going to have a real, each time you eat, you're going to have this real high of energy.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're going to have a crash. When you have that crash, you need more sugar because you think, God, I'm low in energy. Whereas if your energy levels are fairly consistent,
then you're fine.
You're not going to have those urges and cravings.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, it's actually funny that you mentioned sugar. Got another quote here. Okay, I think everyone should ditch sugar completely, no exceptions.
No.
Absolutely not.
No, absolutely not. No. Because the more you tell somebody to ditch something or never have it again, your automatic response is, well, I want it.
Yeah, it's like
me saying to you, well, it's let's say my dad said to me, don't ever go out with a bad boy. What am I going to do? I'm going to go out with a bad boy.
Mm, it's the whole strip
parents thing,
isn't it?
in us, and we naturally have that. When we're told to do something, we're naturally, no.
Yeah.
So to tell somebody that they've got to ditch sugar, it's that all or nothing mindset.
I get that. I mean, I think it's probably more or less leaning into the side of, obviously, you know, people talk about like cutting out sodium or like carbs completely. So like, I'm assuming you're coming from the basis that, you know, everything in the food pyramid is essential somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I think the body coach, he spoke, I think, quite openly. I've not seen it myself. This is what I, the hearsay of what I've seen about that he's addicted to sugar. And he decided that he was going to cut out sugar completely. And I think he did a challenge online. And I looked at that and I thought, no. Because everyone is going to, it's a marketing stunt.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to get on that bandwagon of, right, I'm going to follow the, what's his name again? Joe Wicks. You know, he's got a huge following.
Yeah.
Probably lots of females following him, and it's great what he's done for nutrition and health and getting people into walking, training, running, whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
But then to go on to that slant, and I know that maybe works for him, but it'll be really interesting to see how long he stays off that sugar.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's this is what, for me, I personally believe this is what causes eating disorders.
Mm. There's no such thing as food addiction, just habits.
Oh, where are you getting these from, Hunter? Repeat it to me again.
There's no such thing as food addiction, just habits.
See, with my professional hat on, I would say habits. However, being an emotional eater myself, I'd say the first.
I agree. I emotionally eat as well. That's how I probably put on the weight initially. So,
but I think really do believe there are different levels of emotional eating.
Yeah.
And it's in our nervous system for a reason. It's there most of the time for soothe and comfort.
Yeah.
And I think if it's controlled, it does become a habit. So let's say your emotional eating is probably more likely to happen at home in the evening.
True, yeah.
So for a lot of my patients, I would say, well, you know what? Why don't we use that as an opportunity?
Yeah.
So rather than the bar of chocolate, why don't you have a small amount of chocolate but have something alongside it to make it a better habit? But I think that's a double-ended one. Depends if I've got my professional hat or my personal hat on.
Okay. All right, I've got another one here. Social media makes body images struggles worse, not better.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. Even I will look at images and I'll think, oh my God, my skin's not like that. Oh my God, she looks amazing.
I was
in
just going to say that.
I don't look like that. And then my daughter will say, but Mum, you do. So I find being, and that's why I think sometimes on social media, I don't like being on there. I don't like showing what I'm doing in my personal life because I'm thinking, I don't look as great as those women. It's like the fitness coaches.
Oh, yeah.
Wearing all the skimpy stuff, and it's like a uniform for them.
Yeah. Well, it's like it inflates your expectation and yourself as well, right? Like you're any of these influencers, you're looking at people that are probably 0.001% of, like if we're going on like the fitness realm, like athletes globally, right? Like you can go to any run-of-the-mill gym and like I feel like people will beat themselves up if they're not, especially from like a male perspective. If I'm not benching like 140 kilograms, I feel like I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah.
But then it's like realizing, hold on, like anything over probably 60 is like a pretty valid amount of strength for anyone to have. But you've just got that mindset of what you're seeing online. I think it just completely skews how you should feel about yourself.
Absolutely. And I think there's so many benefits of social media, but I think there's more downsides. And I think this is why we're seeing, it's like even normal people are shrinking. And I'm just thinking, I wonder why.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. All All right, that's that section covered. Call the section the angle check, thanks to Tosin. She's come up with a couple of these little terms that we're going to be fluttering in. But yeah, a bit more lighthearted on kind of the health and wellness side of things as well. What health trend that you've seen recently do you think needs to stop?
Oh, the chia seed flush.
I've seen that. So what, is that when they're putting it into their glasses of water and then...
Yeah, expecting a massive bowel movement.
What does it do? Sorry, it literally...
It's like a huge shot of fibre and people are saying have this gut cleanse drink and they're putting their, you know, their couple of scoops of chia seeds in a pint glass of water and lemon and whatever else you want to put in it.
Just the other
And
stuff.
I just look at it and I'm thinking... Why?
Yeah. So it doesn't do anything.
No, I mean, chia seeds are great for fibre.
Yeah.
But you can sprinkle them on your Greek yogurt and berries in the morning.
Yeah. Don't need to down it in
no,
a
but
pint
it, again,
of water.
It's people will do it. Just and things. These gut resets and, oh.
So are they making a bit of a comeback at the moment? Because I know that that was a thing quite a few years ago.
If I'm really honest... I'm just cool with it all.
Fair.
You know, if somebody believes that it's going to make a difference,
yeah.
it's going to improve their health because they believe it, it's going to happen and they're going to put it down to that reset. I mean, I'm always up for a reset. So for women that regain weight, I do have a reset. But basically, it's like it's going back to them into that honeymoon period of where they felt really happy when they just had the surgery. So I'll say, right, let's do a couple of days of having a few protein shakes,
yeah.
having one meal a day, and then we build back into having normal foods. But it's more for self-regulation so that they can see that, oh gosh, you know, I was probably snacking a lot more.
Yeah.
Because you can have a tiny stomach, but if you're eating constantly every hour on the hour, and it might be a protein bar, it might be a handful of nuts, it might be ice cream bar or chocolate, it all adds up. But if I get them to reset and self-regulate,
yeah.
it's like, oh, I can see what I was doing before.
Yeah.
Okay, I understand. I need to go back to basics.
Mm.
So going back to basics is probably a little bit different to a detox and a complete reset plan. But I see so much of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if somebody thinks it's going to work for them, who am I to deny that from them? But it's a fad. People love a quick fix and a fad.
Definitely. Mm. So what do you make of the... is it the carnivore diets? Have you seen the videos of like a lot of people just eating, you know?
I met some people that are real advocates that have a company that provide the carnivore diet.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to ask, because obviously you see those people with like, you know, chopping boards, they've got their steaks out, avocado, mountain of eggs, banana, honey, dates, like sticks of butter.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? Like, is that, that's obviously very whole, like, organic food from
I'm very
back
much
in Stone Ages.
Do believe that wherever you possibly can have organic and free range because
whole
our food is doused in pesticides which affect our hormones, affect our mental health, they affect so much.
Mm.
So I'm very much if and when you can do it.
Like go to the farmer's market kind of thing, or like
just
buy
even
organically
from the supermarket.
From...
If you can go to the farmer's market.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. My daughter, she always has eggs in the morning.
Yeah.
And she was recently, she's been saying on and off for the last few years, Mum, sometimes I just can't. Something's upsetting my gut. I just feel sick. I feel nauseous.
Mm.
And then I said to her, what sort of eggs are you getting?
Mm.
And she says, oh, just the normal M&S eggs. And I said, try the organic free range. Because free range isn't enough. They're still getting fed pesticides. Foods with grains with pesticides.
Yeah.
If you go organic, the feed will be very different.
Mm.
Is she gone?
Just immediately.
Immediately. She goes, Mom, you're not going to believe this.
Yeah.
I'm not having those issues anymore. And I said, I think the feed that they give to free range hens is not serving you.
So you'd say that organic's like just the full
If you can. So with the carnivore diet, there's a lot of people that are saying that they feel better hormonally menopausal women.
Okay.
But then when this chap was telling his story about the carnivore diet, he then told us all about his relapses. and that when he does then go back onto eating carbs, he puts the weight back on, etc. So I just don't know. But then he goes back into the carnivore phase, and then he'll relapse again. But my thinking is, well, if you just had a little bit of everything and you were just high protein with some moderate carbs and plenty of fiber, then would you avoid the relapse that you're yo-yoing, basically?
Yeah.
You're yo-yoing what every dieter does, whereas if you just had a bit of everything and didn't deny yourself.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are saying they feel better on it. But is that because they believe something like a reset and a detox?
Yeah. So you think it might be slightly placebo in that sense?
But there was a woman there who was alongside this chap. I think it's this company they have together, and it's all about training, the carnivore diet. And she said that she felt so much better on it, going through the perimenopause and the menopause. And I said, well, whatever floats your boat. I'm one of these dietitians that's really open, not just to research and evidence, but real lived experiences.
Yeah.
And I really do think mindset has got a huge part of why things can work and why things can't work.
Definitely. Okay, cool. It's good to know.
You have got to make the lifestyle, the nutritional, the mindset changes to work alongside these tools.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, and this is what I'm seeing with some GLP-1 women, the weight's starting to creep back on. It's that fear.
Yeah.
It's that fear, and it's because they're so reliant on that tool.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for tuning in today. This has been the Another Angle podcast. We've had Van Patel on. It's been an amazing session chatting about all things weight loss. You can catch today's episode across YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Music, and hopefully we'll see you again next week.